Welcome to Torti Mecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Ilana Flamenhaft, and today we will be learning Parshat Shoftim. Our Parsha begins in the middle of Perek Tet Zayin, chapter 16, and continues through Perek Chafal of Pasuk Tet, chapter 21, verse 9. It contains 41 mitzvot, 14 mitzvot aseh, positive commandments, and 27 mitzvot lo taseh, negative commandments. When we learned Parshat Devarim, we discussed that Moshe intentionally arranged and presented the material in his speeches, and that the placement of the passages, one after the other, is understood to reflect purposeful connection. Ibn Ezra attempts to understand the sequence of mitzvot in our Parsha. He wrote, "Afal pi shekol mitzvah u'mitzvah omedet bifnei atzma, yesh kidmut drash lidabei kaparshiot." Even though each and every commandment stands by itself, there is, as it were, a midrashic reason for the connection of the sections. Ibn Ezra comments on the smichut parshiot, the juxtaposition of one mitzvah to another, and begins with the first mitzvah of the parsha, to appoint judges and officers in every city. He questioned why it follows the last mitzvah of the preceding parsha, of the three pilgrimage festivals, the Shalosh Regalim. He explained the connection between appointing judges and the Shalosh Regalim is that although you are obligated to go three times a year to the place where the Kohanim serve in the sanctuary and seek guidance regarding the statutes and laws, that alone is not sufficient. You must also have judges in every one of your cities. The commandment to appoint judges includes pursuing justice, and we are commanded, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice, justice, you shall pursue. Why does the verse repeat the word tzedek, justice, twice? Rashi, based on the Gemara, explains, halokh achar beit din yafeh, follow after a proper, reliable court. The repetition emphasizes how justice is pursued matters as much as the outcome. You cannot achieve justice through unjust means. The pursuit itself has to be righteous. The mitzvah is followed by the prohibition against planting an asherah, a sacred tree for idol worship, next to a mizbeach, an altar. Ibn Ezra explains the connection between appointing judges and the prohibition against planting an asherah, as a judge must first be vigilant in identifying and addressing overt forms of idolatry. The Talmud suggests another message from the placement of the mitzvot. If we appoint a judge who is not qualified, it is as if we are planting an asherah tree near a mizbeach. Perek Yitzayin, chapter 17, discusses the law of an idol worshiper and then proceeds to address a situation when a local court is unable to resolve an issue. It describes the Central Supreme Court, which is referred to as Hamakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place that God will choose. The Torah does not name a specific city, but explicitly dictates that the highest legal authority must sit at this divine site, which was later established as the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. In later rabbinic tradition, the Central Court became known as the Beit Din Hagadol, the Great Court. In 1996, I went to visit my sister who was studying in Israel for the year, and we got into a cab to go on a tour of the Supreme Court. The Nahag, the driver, insisted that he had no idea what we were talking about when we told him he wanted to go to the Beit Din Hagadol, right? The big courthouse. My sister and I were stumped. How could he not know a place as well known as the Supreme Court? We sat there thinking and thinking, and finally, I try a Beit Mishpat Gadol. The driver, in rapid-fire Hebrew, exclaimed in exasperation, "Why didn't you just ask for Beit Mishpat Elyon in the first place?" As a non-native Hebrew speaker, I'd always thought of Din and Mishpat as essentially synonymous. But Beit Din is a specifically rabbinic term for a Jewish court, and it was unfamiliar to our cab driver, who understood the Supreme Court by its modern Hebrew name, Beit Mishpat Elyon. My sister and I had a good laugh, and it was my first real introduction to appreciating the differences between biblical, rabbinic, and modern Hebrew. We are told that the judges are likely to know the correct ruling of the Torah, and they are granted the ultimate authority to decide these cases. We read in Psukim Yud Tiral, verses 10 to 11, "Veshamarta la'asot k'chol asher yerucha, and you shall observe to do according to all they instruct you. Lo tasur mina davar asher yagidu lecha yamin usmol. You shall not deviate from the matter that they will tell you, right or left." The commandment not to veer from the ruling seems pretty clear. What is added by saying right or left? Rashi explains that even if a judge tells you that what seems to you to be right is actually left, or what seems to you to be left is actually right, you are still obligated to follow his ruling. Ramban quotes Rashi and explains that the need for this commandment is very great, for the Torah was given to us in written form, and it is known that not all opinions concur on newly arising matters. Disagreements would thus increase, and the one Torah would become many Torahs. Therefore, the Torah defines that the law that we are to obey, the great court that stands before God in the place that he chose, in whatever they tell us with respect to the interpretation of the Torah. Rabbi Yisachar Fran discusses in Parshas Tetzaveh that a refrain appears throughout the Torah's accounts of the Mishkan as its components were made, Kasher Tziva Hashem et Moshe, as Hashem commanded Moshe. This phrase appears 18 times, far more necessary to simply convey that instructions were followed. Why does the Torah emphasize it so repeatedly? Rav Baruch Mordechai Ezrachi, in Birkat Mordechai, explains that there is something significant about doing a mitzvah exactly as instructed, no more and no less. Human nature resists simply following directions. We want to exercise our independence and add our own creativity. Of course, no one would consider doing less than the Ribono Shel Olam commanded. Heaven forbid. On the contrary, the tendency would be to do more. There's an inclination to say, I want to show my own individuality. Maybe we could do it a little differently. But doing a mitzvah in a no more, no less fashion testifies that the person is not doing it for his own sake, but simply as a servant following the orders of his master. The final passage of chapter 17 outlines the laws governing the appointment and conduct of a Jewish king. Interestingly, it primarily tells us what a king must not do, rather than what he should do. He should not acquire great numbers of horses, or take many wives, or accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. These are the temptations of power, and even the greatest, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, was vulnerable to them. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in his book, Lessons in Leadership, points out that there is one positive and exceptionally important dimension of royalty. The king is commanded to study constantly, v'karabo kol yemei chayav, and he is to read it, the Torah, all the days of his life. Leaders learn. That is the principle at stake here. Yes, they have advisors, elders, counselors, and an inner court of sages. And yes, biblical kings had prophets to bring them the word of Hashem. But those on whom the destiny of the nation turns may not delegate away the task of thinking, reading, studying, and remembering. They are not entitled to say, I have affairs of state to worry about. I have no time for books. The two greatest kings of early Israel, David and Shlomo, were both authors. David of Tehillim and Shlomo of Shir HaShirim, Mishlei and Kohelet. Though few of us are destined to be kings, presidents, or prime ministers, the Torah is emphasizing a broader principle here. Leaders learn. They read. They study. Leaders should never stop learning. That is how they grow and teach others to grow with them. Perek Yudchet, chapter 18, begins with a discussion of Kohanim, priests, and Levites. The discussion of the spiritual leadership of the people continues with the prohibition of sorcery and the position of the Navi, the prophet. As opposed to priests and Levites, whose status is determined by their lineage, one can easily make a mistake when trying to identify a true prophet. A Navi is not recognizable by any outward characteristics or from his origins, as he is simply one of the people who purports to speak in God's name. The Torah informs us that if the prophets say something that does not occur, you will know that the prophet spoke with evil intent and we should not be intimidated him. In chapter 4, Moshe designated three cities on the eastern side of the Jordan River to serve as asylum for unwitting murderers, but they're not operational yet. Now in chapter 19, Moshe tells the people that they need to set aside additional cities of refuge on the western side of the Jordan River. This is followed by the prohibition of moving a boundary, hasagat gvul, and then the commandments related to witnesses. Even Ezra explains the connection between the topics in the chapter. If a neighbor feels that his border has been breached, he's likely to bring witnesses when presenting his case. Respect for borders between neighbors prevents arguments that may deteriorate into disputes that eventually lead to murder, which could require cities of refuge. Chapter 20 contains the laws relating to war. It begins with Bnei Israel's pre-battle preparations and lists the categories of men who are exempt from military duty. It continues with a discussion related to the conduct of the war itself and concludes with a command involving the proper treatment of trees during a siege. We read, Ki tatsura ir yamim rabim li lachem alea letafsa, lo tashchit et eitza lindoach alav garzan, ki mimeno tochal voto lo tachrit, ki ha'adam eitza sadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor. When in your war against a city, you have to besiege it for a long time in order to capture it, you must not destroy its trees, wielding the axe against them. You may eat them, but you must not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man to retreat from you during the siege? Basically, the pasuk is asking, is the tree a person that you're waging war against? The war should be directed against people, not nature. The Talmud derived from here a general obligation to preserve nature and not to destroy items unnecessarily, the mitzvah of Baal Tashchit. It is worth noting that this mitzvah is mentioned in the context of going out to battle. Even then, we're supposed to do what we can to avoid needless destruction. The final paragraph of our parsha is the law of Egla Arufa, the beheaded calf. When an individual is murdered under unknown circumstances, the Zakenim, elders of the nearest cities, must measure the distance from their city to the scene of the crime in order to determine which city is the closest and has to atone for such wanton loss of life. According to the Talmud, in Sota, the measuring must be performed even if it's obvious which city is the closest. This shows that the measuring is not designed only to establish which city is nearest to the corpse, but it expresses the idea that all the inhabitants of that region are implicated in the terrible event. Shadal Shmuel David Lutzato suggested that one reason for this law is lechazek ha'emunah meforsemet ba'uma shekol Yisrael arevim ze lazeh. It strengthens the belief in the Jewish nation that all Jews are responsible for each other. The elders of the city nearest the body take a calf of the herd down to a harsh ravine and they behead the calf there. Then they wash their hands and say, "Our hands did not shed this blood and our eyes did not see." It's particularly striking to consider where the Torah chooses to place the mitzvah of Egla Arufa. The section that follows begins with the words, Ki teitze lemilchama al oivecha, when you go out to war against your enemy. But remarkably, the section immediately preceding Egla Arufa begins with those very same words. The mitzvah of Egla Arufa is therefore literally placed between two passages about war. Why interrupt the laws of warfare with the tragedy of a single individual? Why not group all the laws of war together? Perhaps the Torah is emphasizing the immeasurable value of a single human life. In times of war, when we are confronted with widespread danger and tragedy, it is all too easy for our sensitivity to an individual's suffering to become diminished. By placing Egla Arufa between two passages about war, the Torah stresses the significant importance of each and every life. The Rambam, Maimonides, in chapter 14 of Hilchot Evel, the Laws of Mourning, lists a variety of rabbinic obligations towards one's fellow man that fulfill the underlying biblical command of loving one's neighbor as oneself. He lists in Halacha Aleph, the first paragraph, visiting the sick, comforting the mourners, burying the dead, helping brides get married, gladdening grooms and brides, and accompanying guests, among other rabbinic obligations towards one's fellow man. Then, in the next paragraph, Halacha Bet, the Rambam states, Schar halaviyah meruba minakol, that the reward for accompaniment is greater than for anything else. It's pretty surprising that accompanying guests tops the list in terms of reward, but that is exactly what the Rambam writes. Why is this so? Because when we accompany another person, we give her something fundamental to the human condition, dignity, kavod. We can give someone food or clothing. And while a person may endure hunger or go without the finest clothes, there is something even more essential to the human spirit. Every person needs dignity. Every person needs to feel valued, respected, and taken seriously. Every person needs to feel that she matters. Perhaps this is the message the Torah wants us to learn. We live in a world that constantly pulls our attention toward the big picture, the larger crisis, the greater mission, the demands of the community. But the Torah reminds us that no matter how large the battle, the individual can never become invisible. Every person we encounter is carrying something we cannot see. And sometimes the most meaningful thing we can give another person is not a solution or a resource or even an answer. It is simply the recognition, I see you, you matter. We honor the dignity of another person when we notice them, listen to them, take them seriously, and treat them as someone whose presence matters. Have a good Shabbos.